Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm very happy to have with me today on Research Matters, Dr. Noel Aquilina. Dr. Aquilina graduated with a BSc in Physics and Chemistry from the University of Malta in 1994. After obtaining a PGCE in 1995, he taught physics at O and A level. In 2002, he obtained an MSc in Atmospheric Physics from this university. And from 2003 till 2004, he was recruited as a researcher in the European Commission Research Training Network, RTN, called ATREOS. And that acronym stands for Advanced Tools for Rational Energy Use Towards Sustainability in the University of Aveiro in Portugal to carry out mesoscale modelling. Between 2004 and 2007, he obtained a Health Effects Institute USA scholarship to read for a PhD at the University of Birmingham, UK. Within the MATCH, another acronym, Measurement and Modelling of Exposure to Air Toxic Concentrations for Health Effects Studies project, under the supervision of Professor Roy Harrison. Dr. Aquilina joined the physics department here at the university in 2008. Welcome, Dr. Aquilina. Well, certainly the listeners will immediately realize that your interests, your main interests lie in pollution and measuring of the toxic effects of our atmosphere. And of course, this is a very topical issue. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of interested people waiting to hear what you have to say about this project. The title of the project which you were working on up until the time that you joined the physics department here, I see, was entitled Measurement and Modelling of Exposure to Selected Air Toxics for Health Effects Studies and Verification by Biomarkers. It was the overarching aim, let's say, of the project itself.
So first of all, good morning and thank you for the invitation. So this project basically wanted to explore the personal exposure. When we say personal exposure, it means what we inhale. And we wanted to look at a range of air toxics. Air toxics is quite a broad word, but we wanted to look at a suite of compounds. In general, they are called volatile organic compounds and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And these compounds, as defined by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, they are carcinogenic. Some of them are proven to be, some of them are potential carcinogenic. So obviously they have a health impact, which is very important. So the main aim was to quantify what the exposure, the personal exposure is to these compounds. And the other objectives were to quantify by compound what we inhale in particular situations, depending on where we live, what are our activities, and to optimize this information, you need to take measurements, then you develop models, which are called personal exposure models, and the reason is that doing measurements is very expensive. So you can take some measurements, develop models. Using some of the data, you can validate the model. So you see if what you are proposing is actually related to what you actually measure. And then we wanted to categorize the different exposure to different compounds, basically according to the lifestyle of people.
So you were looking at people in a urban situation, a rural situation. Where else did you go to look for your subjects?
Okay, so basically the plan was we were funded to have 100 adult subjects, And the idea was to see the extreme of exposures. Basically, when we say extremes, you can have hot spots, which are generally the urban situations, and obviously a cleaner environment like rural areas. So the target places were London, Wales, which is quite rural, and obviously Birmingham for logistic reasons was the main monitoring area. And we wanted to look at different environments, so not only the normal houses. So we went into offices, transport systems like trains, buses, individual cars, streets. So we made measurements in various streets in the three cities, and also in the homes of the subjects. So when we had permission, we could sample their homes, which gave us quite a broad information on their activities during the sampling period, which was for a week. And part of the data was also collected in a format of a questionnaire, so we could relate what we were measuring to what activity were the subjects doing, and also related to where they were.
So the pollutants that you were talking about, these toxic agents, were they related to one particular activity or smoking, or were you looking into traffic fumes? Were you looking at different areas in that sense?
Yeah, in fact, that is where the modeling comes in, because unfortunately these sources, they don't have a single source, so we needed to identify different sources. There is a main, let's say, trait for the two categories. So basically the volatile organic compounds come more from traffic, from smoking, and from cleaning products, because they are volatile. And one of these compounds is called 1,3-butadiene, which very lately it has struck the interest of the scientific community in personal exposure, for the simple fact that it is very toxic compared to benzene, which has been always the, let's say, the compound to refer to. Up to now, the data is only related to animal studies. It hasn't been really shown in terms of human health impacts, but definitely this is much, much more toxic than benzene, and therefore a short exposure to it would most probably have much more impact on various possible cancers that can this compound can lead to.
And where exactly is it found, this particular?
This compound is widely used in the rubber industry. So any product which needs rubber or nylon or most of the polymer production, plastics, its base unit is 1,3-butadiene. So that is, let's say, an occupational exposure. But then for the rest, it comes from any burning, any combustion of materials. So again, if you have traffic, if you have smoking, if you have any combustion in homes, and any burning like forest fires, for example, this will be always one of the compounds. So that for this we had as well a special treatment for this compound. And then the other group, which is the polycyclic aromatic PAHs, also called PAHs, these are quite new in the exposure areas, and their main source is again burning. So whatever you burn, so again we will have traffic, smoking, and anything which inside the homes we burn, like stoves, cookers, barbecues, they will generate these compounds. And all of them, they can lead to different cancers. Generally, we look more into the lung cancer.
The recent idea about banning smoking and this sort of thing has been welcomed here in Malta. Certainly we've sort of got used to it now, although there are certain countries in the Mediterranean, like Greece, where there have been a lot of objections to it. Really, what you're saying is that people in urban areas can't really actually get away from this, because even if you if you have a smoke-free environment at home, you're going to be passively taking and smoking. We know that that's also a problem. But even just walking out of your door is going to really be exposing yourself to these amounts of toxic components.
Yeah, in fact, when in my introduction I said that there might be as well some misconceptions, and in fact this is where it comes in. People have the idea that the exposure to these nasty air toxics comes outside. However, in our project here and various other projects, on average, we always spend about 8% either indoors, so either at home or at work generally. So really, we should look at the exposures that we have in these environments. So when we speak about the outside air pollution, we have to take care how we look at it, because we don't really spend that much time outside. As well, it's not such a simple system, so you cannot really look at the different sources independently from each other. And why I'm saying this, the reason is that if the air outside is pretty nasty, we have a lot of infiltration which comes in. And in Malta, we don't use, at least not in the normal homes, we don't use air exchange systems. So our air is only changed by opening windows. So if the air outside is dirty, it's going to come inside, and to it you add the indoor sources. So when you were mentioning about the smoke-free legislation, obviously I agree that it had a very positive impact on the leisure industry. However, the situation at homes, I'm not sure how people behave over here. I noticed as well since my return that a lot of people smoke in Malta in their cars, for example, which is quite a small environment, so the air toxics will be quite concentrated. So imagine if you have your kids in the back seat and the air there is not really well circulated, and particularly from smoking, a lot of the compounds that I mentioned, when they are generated from the tobacco smoke, they stick to clothes, to different furnishings, and then after some time they just get off from the clothes and we inhale them again. So it's not just during the smoking where the problem lies, it is quite a long-term exposure.
Yes, you don't get rid of them just by controlling the smoking in the room. It sort of hangs on, and it will also be old stuff. That's what always worries me so much about passive smoking. The idea that I'm actually inhaling something that's been in somebody else's lungs before really irritates me a lot. Certainly, I prefer going out to dinner now that there isn't any smoking in the restaurants, that's for sure. But I quite understand that that's only removing a very small part of the problem. In the project that you were working on, clearly you had many partners. I mean, we mentioned Professor Roy Harrison, of course, and there were other people, other universities involved. Who were they?
Okay, so mainly the biggest team was at Birmingham. So apart from Professor Harrison, who was the principal investigator, and myself, there were three other people. So one of them took care of the logistics to organize all the sampling campaigns, which basically took 2 years. Then there was the chief chemist, and he did most of the analytical work together with myself. And there was also the project manager, who basically looked how the project was running. Whenever we had problems, we just sorted them out.
The paperwork, because that's even the paperwork with these projects, yes, is a major undertaking.
Yeah, generally it was I wasn't involved in the paperwork.
How lucky you were.
That was mainly the project coordinator and the person who took care of the logistics. So that was the Birmingham team, and basically we did all the sampling ourselves. Myself, for example, I designed and built all the equipment that was needed, and it gave us a good time for the whole 2 years. And then the other partners were Professor Ian Matthews from the Cardiff University, for the simple fact that, as the title said, we also had a biomonitoring program. So from our subjects, we collected a urine sample for every day of sample, and basically we used it to, as we collected a sample per day, that means that we could look into the body fluid and see what the body was exposed to by analyzing some compounds which you can extract from this body fluid. Some people use blood, hair. There are several ways, but the project was designed on urine. And Ian Matthews had good experience on these. Basically, we wanted to look at two particular biomarkers, which one is for benzene. So you just find a compound which comes from benzene, and you can say how much benzene has been inhaled. And the other one was for tobacco smoke, and that is called cotinine, which is a product from nicotine. And then what happened later on, we had some problems with this method development. So we went for another group, which is in the United States. So this group has about 25 years experience in biomonitoring, specifically on tobacco smoke. And luckily enough, we really got some good work together, because they had developed other methods for various other compounds. So apart from the benzene biomarker and the smoke biomarker, we looked as well at the pHs biomarkers, which is quite a new area of research as well. And then there was as well Professor Ross Anderson and Dr. Vardulakis from the University of London, who basically looked more into the statistics that always accompanies these large data sets.
So you were really doing something that was also multidisciplinary. You needed for this project not just chemists, but other people to be involved as well. And was that an interesting experience for you, dealing with other areas?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I learned a lot of statistics because I needed it to analyze my data. And as well, I had the opportunity to visit the group in the US and discuss in big detail how we're going to have a collaborative work, because with this group, it wasn't originally in the original project plan. So it just came along in terms, I was there, I was discussing the methods. So we said, okay, why don't you look at other stuff? And that really worked out to give us even more information.
One thing which always interests people is, where did the money come from? For this project, where did your money come from?
Okay, so
your money, the money for the project.
Okay, so the Health Effects Institute was the funding body. So the Health Effects Institute, although it is in the U.S. and funds a lot of U.S. projects, but it funds a lot of international projects. So obviously, Professor Herzen in the Aerosol Chemistry Society, he is worldwide now, so that's why he could attract this type of funding. And basically, the HEI gets its funding from the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and also from the motor vehicle industry, for the simple fact that, as we know, traffic exhaust, it generates a lot of these compounds that we mentioned. So they have the interest to fund this type of research. And in fact, whoever goes on the HEI website will note that apart from this project, there are several projects which either ended at this time as well or are still running. So these air toxics, from various aspects, the HEI funds a lot, gives a lot of money to do this research.
Because, in fact, talking of the car industry, I mean, there is always this idea that there might be vested interest when it comes to these kind of projects. And I suppose it's important to say that it's independent and peer-reviewed work that comes out of this at the end of the day. So it's not being, the tab is not being picked up by people who have vested interests in it. I suppose that's an important point to make. About the methodology, you were saying before that you had volunteers who offered urine samples and that sort of thing. How did you go about attracting volunteers to the project?
Yes, in fact, initially the project needed a lot of planning, how we're going to match the objectives in order to say, okay, we need the personal exposure models for the various compounds. And we wanted to say, okay, where is the model going to look at? So basically, there were inclusion and exclusion criteria how we chose the subjects. And basically, the criteria were, we chose people who lived in urban areas, in suburban areas, and rural areas. So that gives a difference between the hotspots, which are related to traffic, like London, and the cleaner side, which is Wales. And Birmingham is supposedly a bit away in between. And also, if they were exposed to tobacco smoke at home or not, we were looking at 100 non-smokers, and the reason is that we know that the smokers are exposed quite a lot, but the problem lies, as you mentioned before, in passive smoking. So we went for people who were either exposed or not, and basically if at home someone smokes, you will be exposed. If not, then you are not. And as well, to try to avoid the too much influence of traffic, we excluded people who traveled a lot to work. So basically, if they traveled more than 2 hours in a car a day, those were excluded. And
you could easily do that as a commuter, an hour to work and an hour back again.
Yes. So at times it wasn't easy to recruit the ideal people. So basically, we had a matrix with these characteristics, and we tried to find the people who fit. Now, the strategy to attract the volunteers, we used various strategies. So basically, we had an information program on the BBC when the project was launched. We used the newspapers, various newspapers, flyers. We used the internet as well, and letters in various areas which were particularly important. We used word of mouth as well, and some friends as well. It's quite difficult to fit all the people and get the right people you need.
How many people do you think were involved in all in this, as far as volunteers are concerned? Tens, hundreds, how many people?
The project was funded for 100 people, and at times from the statistical point of view, people would say, okay, a 100 sample is too little. So then it would create problems in terms of analyzing the data, where you say, okay, is this statistically significant? Mm-hmm. When you say statistically significant, it means what you see in a sample of 100, would that replicate for a population? So there is a bit of, give and take how much people. The reason is that not only to collect, we paid the people to participate for 5 days. So they carried a sampler with them in order to get the personal exposure of VOCs and butadiene. That was for 5 days. On one of the days, we collected as well the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And for the 5 days, we collected a urine sample. So then basically, apart from collecting the samples, you just need to analyze them, where most of the cost lies then.
Mm. What about deliverables? These projects always have to have a deliverable and should have, after all that work. I think you have a website where people could actually go and sort of see where the work is at www.healtheffects.org. And then they search for what?
So then on the left-hand side of the website, there is a link called publications, and if they search for publication 143, it's a research report, or else they search for Roy M. Harrison, and they would have not only the main report, but as well a lot of data where one can look at.
And putting out the information, getting other people to read it, to talk about it, getting it in the hands of the policymakers. How do you do that?
Yeah, obviously these type of projects generally generate a lot of research papers. We are already at 6 and we have a couple of more to write. In terms of dissemination, yes, we were involved in, while I was there at least, in 7 conferences. So
discussed, get your message across.
Yeah, we discussed the various stages of the results in conferences, and they are useful because, you know, one can get feedback on things that can be done in a different way or better or else it can serve for other people to build on what we found.
Future plans? You were telling me before that data is on a platform that can be used by other scholars. So that already is a way of carrying the project into the future, isn't it?
Yes, obviously. I mean, it all depends at times on the nature of the project. In our case, it was a specific research project looking into the science of these compounds. However, that would be a bit not so useful if you just stop over there. So the database contains all the data that we collected, and generally these type of data sets serve as a platform for epidemiology studies. So basically one would look then at the health effects and what risk factors these compounds create, and that's where the model as well comes in. So the models serve as an informative way how you can use this data. And as regards the future plans, obviously I'm still in contact with the various groups, and there are a lot of things which are still unanswered. So, you know, one would be planning most probably a sequel project. From my point of view over here in Malta, obviously, as the island it has a different climate characteristics compared to a colder country like the UK. These compounds behave differently. So,
a lot of work to do here.
Yeah, a lot of work, and the data available now is quite limited. So we can have a bit of an idea where we lie in terms of exposure to these compounds.
Thank you so much, Dr. Noel Aquilina, for coming to talk to us about this really topical, fascinating project. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
I do hope you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.